thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
It's Digital Campus number 90, recorded on the 7th of September, 2012. It's our back-to-school special. And we are back for a new season, I believe our sixth season of the Digital Campus podcast. Hi, I'm Dan Cohen with a more baritone voice than usual, in my Barry White late-night jazz voice. I've got a cold, but I am excited to be here with apparently healthy other Digital Campus podcasters, Amanda French. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, how's it going? How was your summer?
My summer was great. It was great.
Great. Tom Scheinfeld's here, about to deliver a baby live on air. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hi, everybody. I'll save the audience that that experience. Yes, but we're waiting for a baby that is imminent. So. Any day now.
It's great you're podcasting from the hospital. That's very kind of you.
It's dedication. Yeah, dedication to all you, our listeners.
Commitment.
Mills Kelly is also here. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing good. You know, it just happens.
Yeah, well, I spent the whole summer sick, I think, so I get it.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Are you all better?
Seemingly, although... we'll find out soon. You know, you have to do a million follow-up visits with the doctors.
I'm sure being on Twitter has been very healing for you.
It has been good for me. It has certainly given me something to do during my many hours of just feeling bleh.
You had pneumonia, is that right?
Twice.
Oh, gosh. Gosh.
Once was just not enough for me. Right. But let me tell you, the Olympics are a good thing when you're sick. I'm so up on team handball now.
Hey, that is a great sport.
I didn't even know it existed, but now I'm like way into I'm way into the Montenegrin team.
Yep, it's it's huge in Israel where my sister lives, which I understand now. I understand why. It's fantastic.
If you want to know, this is completely off topic, of course, but if you want to keep up on team handball, follow Stefan Fatsis, who is on NPR on Fridays and writes for the Wall Street Journal. But he is a mainstream sports reporter who also covers team handball. So,
good to know. We'll link to that from campus.tv. Right. Audrey Waters is joining us. Welcome back to the podcast, Audrey.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And I hear you are now in Hollywood. You've gone Hollywood on us.
South of Hollywood, actually, I think this is the land of beach volleyball.
Beach volleyball.
Speaking of Olympic sports, I'm in Hermosa Beach, California now.
Ah, wow, that sounds lovely.
It is. It is quite lovely. So,
too much.
I hope your move went okay. I saw some terrifying tweets from the LA DMV and places like that. But
yeah, that was the. You know, that was the wonderful welcome that you get when you move to California is the 4-hour initiation that for your driver's license. So
right.
I successfully completed that little hurdle, though.
That's great. Well, I hear they only let really good drivers drive in California.
Great. Well, I don't actually drive, but so we'll see. We'll see. I just have a license just, you know, for one of those emergency things. I'm a walker public transportation person.
Good.
So. Good.
Also, so you can vote probably in the future.
Yes, because after watching 2 weeks of Democratic and Republican Party conventions, boy, I'm just so fired up to live in a democracy. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, that's good.
I'm fired up to live in a sarcastocracy.
Well, from the very unsarcastic mountains of Vermont, we are also joined by Brian Alexander. Welcome back, Brian.
Hey, guys. I guess
I guess I get to be not only unsarcastic, but I didn't follow the Olympics. I never follow the Olympics. I don't watch TV. And the spectacle of those two conventions depressed me mightily. So I get to be an outlier.
Well, it's good to have you back, Brian. I think this is the third or fourth year in a row that we've had you on the Back to School podcast. So we need to get you a T-shirt or a trucker's hat that says that.
Well, that'd be great.
Honorary Back to School regular on the Digital Campus podcast.
Would that fit on a cap?
That's a good question. We'll get you a very large cap.
It'll go all the way around a big circle.
Right, like
a beanie.
A big Russian hat for the winter up there in Vermont.
That'd be good. That'd be my second one. Excellent.
Okay, we will go to cafepress.com after this podcast and get you that. Well, let's dig right in. You know, being sick and Mills being sick, I started thinking maybe these MOOCs aren't such a bad idea. You know, I get these colds from all the students coming back from the summer. Maybe if we just moved our entire academic enterprise online, we'd be okay. I know we've kind of beaten the horse of the MOOC quite a bit on this podcast, but it has been quite a summer MOOC-wise. Quite a few launches, a lot of controversy. I know, you know, running Digital Humanities Now, that we've had a lot of lengthy and argumentative blog posts on what's going on. And I think some of the stories that kind of happened over the summer had to do with how rigorous these courses really are. Audrey, maybe if we can go to you first. You, I think, notice a lot of sort of the undercurrents in these MOOCs, potential for plagiarism, the very male young orientation of the support groups, because you're not getting any support from the instructor in a 100,000 person course. What did you make of this summer? Things that caught your eye, new courses that went online, some of the debates that have gone on?
I think one of the things I was looking forward to most about Coursera, which was one of the two startups that launched out of Stanford, was that they promised to have a peer grading system to their MOOCs in lieu of the sort of automated robo-graders that some of these other classes have utilized. And so a couple of the classes that used peer assessment launched this summer. Chuck Severance's Internet History class, which I signed up for and dropped, and the Science Fiction and Fantasy class, which I had the same sort of trajectory. And I think that what was interesting for me, particularly about that class, was that when I watched the videos for the first week, the essays, the students were assigned to write essays that they would grade each other's essays. And the first warning bell was when these essays were assigned to be 270 words in length, which seems a little short.
it's about the size of an introduction to a normal history paper.
Right. Yeah. And so
just the introduction.
That was the first sort of sign that all was not well in the peer assessment camp.
I have to disagree with that though, because I have some background with this. Not only did I write those essays as an undergrad in Eric's classes, but also when I became a grad student, I TA'd them. And the pedagogical thrust is actually very effective. The assignment requires people to write a complete essay in that shorter frame once a week. And it's a terrific, terrific way to get students to write, to strip out puffery and baggage and padding, and just to write a very concrete essay. I have to admit, it actually changed my writing. It made it much harder for me to write some of the longer pieces when I get the job done in a quicker time.
So, Brian, I want to get back to Audrey's criticism in just a second, but you've actually witnessed this course live in a traditional academic setting and saw it ported online. Was there any difference in the course?
I didn't see that mechanism ported online. I experienced it face-to-face, both as a student and as a TA. The class did have a substantial online component, a discussion board, but that's a different thing.
Okay. So back to you, Audrey. What did you notice as you read through some of the other students' papers? I mean, what were the issues that you had?
I think that this was You know, I think that this probably does get back to some of, to Brian's point, which was that I think that we, you know, when you make these assignments in a face-to-face class, particularly when you use, and when you use peer assessment and peer review in a class as well, you know, there's a certain, I think that it's sort of, there's an expectation that the students know each other, that they have a relationship, that there's a certain amount of reciprocity and almost, I mean, an ownership for the feedback that you give your fellow students. And that didn't really translate online. Students really struggled with this assignment in terms of the ability to write those short responses. And they really struggled with their ability to provide meaningful feedback for each other as well. Of course, it was all anonymous, and there wasn't really any sort of good help for people who needed help with both the writing and needed help with offering feedback. And in fact, it turned into some of the examples turned into sort of like the nasty internet troll like behavior.
Interesting. So it's actually anonymous. It's not even persistent pseudonyms, in other words, like we have on Twitter, where people have handles and they kind of stick through it with that over the course. So you kind of get to know a personality, even if it's a weird, made up name.
It was anonymous. And I think you were asked to respond, I think, write a 30-word response to your peer's paper. And some of the responses were literally writing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 through 30 in order to sort of meet that word limit. I mean, the behaviors were shockingly bad.
Amanda, you've assigned short weekly papers, page or less, maybe in this ballpark. What's your experience with that in a normal classroom? And then what have you noticed from the summer in terms of these critiques of the actual, I guess we call it homework for these MOOCs?
Well, one thing that I'll talk about my experience assigning one-page papers in a sec, but one of the things that I had noticed from some of the blog posts about this particular MOOC was how many of the students were not native English speakers. Mm-hmm. And that I understood that a lot of the peer critiques, mentioned that sometimes unkindly, and that this was a big problem. It's of course one of if you're a pro MOOC, that's one of their advantages, is that they do reach across the world. And I had seen some discussion about what to do about this problem of their just some people just needing remedial English writing skills.
Right.
And they I did see an interesting proposal that maybe you could get peer graders who are native speakers of that language to grade maybe in that language, get people to write in that language. So I'm actually willing to cut MOOCs a little bit of slack, I think, for being experimental. And that being said, I do want to maybe support Brian's point that in general, maybe short writing assignments are not that bad. My own pedagogical reason for assigning short weekly papers was that I thought that they were really effective in literature survey courses. I kind of always thought that, the point of a literature survey course, really any survey course, is breadth, not depth. So in my experience, like giving people really in-depth writing assignments in a course whose primary goal is breadth didn't really work. I wanted to make sure that they were reading a lot and getting at least a little bit out of everything. And I didn't feel that a survey course was the place to really teach you to write an extended form. So I did find the one-page papers really effective in making sure that people had done the reading and that they could do at least a little bit of prose thinking about that reading. So, and students, again, having done this live, what we did do was share those papers, too. That was the other thing, is that we, in these literature survey courses that I would teach, where we would have one-page written responses, I would pick out some of the best ones and, mention a couple of sentences from them in class and ask people to respond to it. And students said that they liked it. I mean, maybe just because it was easier, but many students said it wasn't easier. It was actually harder to write that kind of way. So in principle, I don't object to short writing assignments, but it does sound to me like in the specific environment of this MOOC, it wasn't necessarily a good thing.
Mm. Mills, what are you making of, now that we know more about the actual assignments and sort of homework that these MOOCs are assigning, which, you know, unsurprisingly, I suppose, are short and tend to be quiz-based or, you know, very, very short writing, just given their scale and the fact that there are these issues like multilingualism. I think I saw one study that one of those big Coursera courses, over 100,000 person courses, someone did a study, and I think there were over 50 languages spoken in just one course. So what are you making as we kind of hear more details and as, I mean, certainly the executives in these commercial MOOCs are saying that, you know, they'll address these issues to get to their learning objectives.
You know, a number of years ago, the faculty at Foothills College, the community college in the Palo Alto area, had a great slogan, and their slogan was, "Show me the learning." And that's what I want to see. I don't want to see how many people take these courses. I don't want to see, you know, I don't want to see the business models about that. What I want to see is evidence that actual learning was occurring. And right now, this is all being driven by how many people can we get into these courses? How much, you know, it, like how much can we scale this up? And none of it is about actual assessment of learning. It's about assessment of access and assessment of efficiency and things like that. So I have I'm going to withhold judgment until I see the learning. And because I'm entirely skeptical of any teaching model which is predicated on showing students a whole lot of video lectures and then asking them to answer questions on a quiz. There's all sorts of evidence from, you know, cognitive psychologists to show that that's just not very effective in terms of generating real learning. Mm-hmm. And so I'm skeptical about that. The writing model and the peer assessment model I'm less skeptical of, but I want to see the learning. And so I want to see the actual evidence of learning. And so when a year from now, the people running these various MOOC courses can begin to generate some data about, you know, comparative data about learning that occurs or doesn't, and compare that to sort of more traditional delivery models, then I think we can have an intelligent conversation about whether this is a good idea or not. And so I'm just, call me a skeptic, because I'm a skeptic about instruction in general.
Right.
I think the vast majority of instruction that occurs on college campuses in the United States is just not all that fantastic. And so it's not like a MOOC criticism. It's just a part of a broader criticism that I have of how instruction occurs, especially in any sort of large course environment.
Sure, so. Sure.
Do you know, Mills, I went to the Microsoft Research Faculty Summit and heard a computer scientist at Berkeley talk about the MOOC he had taught. And one of the things he said that sort of got cheers in the room was that, you know, whatever you think of MOOCs, at least they're fostering a discussion about teaching among higher education faculty. And a lot of people clapped, and I totally agreed with that.
Yeah, that's a great point. That is a really good point.
I think the other piece, and this doesn't quite get at what you were seeing, but the other thing we saw this summer was the news that several of these MOOCs now, Udacity and I think just a couple days ago, edX, the Harvard MIT initiative, have partnered with Pearson in order to offer proctored final exams for these. So, I mean, I don't think it gets to this question of are students learning, but it certainly gets to the question of have we found a way to sort of bring this assessment conversation and Pearson back into the fold. And so I think that that's a pretty interesting development as well.
Yeah, I mean, it almost seemed inevitable as the stories about rampant plagiarism started leaking out this summer, which I think was the other sort of big stream of stories. We'll link to Jeffrey Young's piece, for instance, in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, you know, discovered that there was, you know, quite a bit of this plagiarism or, you know, quasi-plagiarism, especially you know, students who don't quite get that, you know, copying whole paragraphs from Wikipedia is a form of cheating. So, you know, these learning outcomes and assessment, rigorous assessment, sort of inevitably move toward some kind of physical presence, right, at least for the final exam. Tom, what did you make of this issue of the, you know, the question of cheating and what it really means to finish a course and finish the assignments effectively?
I guess it gets to my hesitation about MOOCs in general, whether or not they're proven to be effective, whether or not the learning outcomes, we can prove the learning outcomes. And that's, I guess, and this is, you know, this is, I guess, kind of squishy and maybe old fashioned, but it's the difference between training and education. You know, these new MOOCs may be useful as to deliver knowledge, but that's not that education is not the purpose of education is not just to, you know, it's not a knowledge communication system only. You know, there's all of the learning that happens in the spaces in between that don't happen in the classroom. So I think, you know, you compare, you know, the outcomes in Mills's classroom with 20 kids versus the outcomes in a MOOC with, you know, 20,000 kids. And, you know, you can compare those things. But then there's all the things that happen, you know, after class when Mills is in the hallway talking to a kid about, for instance, you can't really copy Wikipedia wholesale and present it as a paper, you know, and the reason why and what that means to be a scholar and what that means to be an educated person and what, you know, intellectual theft is. And those kinds of issues, those happen in the spaces in between. And I feel like that's what is kind of lost with MOOCs. And so while they may be useful training vehicles, they might, that's not the same as being, that's not the same as education.
Yeah, certainly a critical point, these sort of meta parts of education that go on. You know, I did see just yesterday or the day before here at George Mason that Tyler Cowan and Alex Tabarrok, who run the very popular Marginal Revolution blog at marginalrevolution.com, they launched their own university for sort of intro economics courses. I think they're starting with a course on development economics. And there was an interesting follow-up from Matt Iglesias today in Slate about Tyler and Alex's new effort in that he sort of saw it as, you know, I think as I sort of see it, that here's a great way that they're offering free courses in, you know, development in the third world. And you know, Matt was saying that it'd be great if really smart kids from outside the United States, from poor countries, took this free online course, that it wasn't there for, you know, regular, you know, average college students in the United States, that it was in some sense sort of gift labor from these two economists to provide training to smart and self-motivated students. And it just strikes me still no one has really answered this question of how MOOCs fit into a world in which, you know, a vast majority of college students really often need sort of more basic training or hand-holding through a course versus, you know, really smart students who could just as easily learn from a book as they could from a MOOC. So I still have deep questions about that.
This is Brian. I agree. The piece reminded me of Allison Byerly's article about strategic purposes for institution launching MOOCs. And her first question, this is in the Chronicle a few days ago, was to distinguish between MOOCs as a public good, something an institution or a person is offering for the public weal of humanity, or is it basically, well, she didn't say PR, she says enhance your institution's position. And looking at this class, it really does sound like the former, as a public good, but also as an opportunity to enhance the two economists' reputation or position globally. Also, I can't get away from the fact that the name of their campus looks like Mr. University.
Jason Kodke made a really good unsolicited suggestion that they change the name of the university from Marginal Revolution University, which is at a URL, MR University, which does look a lot like Mr. University. Some kind of child's toy to just Revolution University. I think that was a good suggestion.
That's a good name if it hasn't already been taken.
Yeah.
What they're offering, though, does it sounds interesting to compare to another economist's MOOC being launched also from Virginia. University of Mary Washington, Stephen Greenlaw, is launching his macro MOOC. He already has the, and he split up in an interesting way. And I'm mentioning this because he's doing it for a different purpose. He has Econ 201 that he's teaching this fall, and he has all the materials online through the famous University of Mary Washington blogs host. And then that's open to the world for everybody else to play with. At the same time, he's launching a macro MOOC, and there's a site for it, but I think it really goes live with content next week. And his idea is partly to share this content with the world, but also I think he really wants to enrich the conversation. So, I mean, this is one of the things that MOOCs can do well by taking advantage of scale that you really can't do with a lecture class face-to-face on campus. I mean, the idea of just getting as many different perspectives and angles on macroeconomics as possible from around the world should enrich not only that conversation, but the Econ 201 University of Mary Washington face-to-face class conversation. I think that's an interesting strategy. That's not an institutional strategy. I mean, this is one professor doing one class. But I think it's pretty interesting. It might be repeated.
Yeah, it's, I think there's some interesting possibilities for hybridity and sort of online elements getting back into the classroom. Okay, well, before we beat the horse too deadly, we will move on to a new story, actually sort of an ironic story. It was over this summer that Mills Kelly finally joined Twitter. Congratulations, Mills.
Why, thank you.
And, of course, just as he joined, a bunch of us decamped over to the startup app.net.
I knew I should have taken a bet.
Mills, but here's your chance. You can still get your username on app.net.
Oh, it's still there, huh?
I believe so, unless someone cruelly bought it. And indeed, we should bring this up immediately for those who haven't seen it. If you go to alpha.app.net, or if you're excited and want to join, join.app.net. There's a new service that's looking a lot on the surface like a clone of Twitter, except you pay $50 a year to participate. Audrey, you're on there with me. I've been getting such grief from the developers here at CHNM about joining. They believe it's a... it shows that I would like join Scientology or something, that I have paid $50 to do something I could do for free on Twitter. Why did you join? Why are you there?
It does. I debated joining for a long time for a lot of those reasons. I want to back it up and say that the reason for this exodus from Twitter is that Twitter continues to sort of display what feel to like a lot of people like some sort of bad practices or certainly acts of bad faith towards its developer community, announcing sort of warning that changes were coming to its API, rolling out some changes finally this week to sort of make it harder for people to build on the platform, if we even can call it a platform, without Twitter's approval. And so it feels as though that sort of initial spirit of being part of a tool that was open, that encouraged third-party developers, now feels like it's becoming a way for them to sell advertising and sort of make deals with major media companies and sort of screw over the little guy. So I think some of the questions around app.net, which was a project from a serial entrepreneur named Dalton Caldwell, I think there are a number of concerns about sort of will his model be any different? Certainly it looks like he promises that he's not going to sort of sell his soul to Silicon Valley investors and to media companies. But it's, you know, promises, promises, promises. So I joined because I was sort of interested in seeing what exactly was going on app.net, which right now seems to be mostly complaining about Twitter and then sort of various developers sort of working on early stage apps to support the new platform.
Right. I joined as well, I think, just as a, you know, I like to support things that, you know, I feel potentially can give some competition to existing services. And I saw a lot of what was going on with Twitter as not something that I liked. Although I've got issues, I suppose, with parts of app.net, it seemed like it'd be nice to have a counterpoint to Twitter. And I do have to say, I like the 256 characters is a whole lot better than 140. As an editor's aside here, especially to Scientologists in our audience, I apologize and retract all my statements about Scientology. I will join that as well, in addition to app.net, when the podcast finished.
I think you're more in danger of getting death threats from the pro-brevity community, Dan. You're being very anti-brevity.
The pro-140s?
Yes. And the pro-270 words people.
Right. the criticisms have been that it's a sort of country club, and I think it's off in that. Oh, and also that it's, skews white and male and young. There was a piece on BuzzFeed analyzing the early membership of app.net. I agree, actually, that it's highly skewed male and young, certainly younger than me. Let's be honest. I mean, who were the first 10,000 users of Slashdot or Twitter, for that matter, or any device, any new shiny device or web service? Brian did tweet earlier, and I find this interesting. I haven't checked it out yet, but also there's a real, let's call it curve to who's posting. There's only supposedly about 250 people posting about half the content so far, and there's been over 250,000 posts on a service that's only about 1 month old. That strikes me as particularly odd and probably not true for early Twitter, although I haven't looked at the numbers there. Tom, are you? I'm surprised you are an early adopter. You're not on it yet.
No, I'm not. And I was telling Brian in the chat before we got on that I have been to the sign up page probably, well, at least half a dozen times. And was sort of getting ready to find my wallet and pay and all of that, and kind of said, you know what, I don't have time for this. I'm going to move on. And my justification for that was, well, there's not really anybody there yet anyway. And as Brian pointed out to me, that's kind of self-reinforcing, isn't it? I imagine that's the experience of a lot of people, that you already have, you know, sort of, you don't, there's no urgency to it because you have this channel already that is doing the job for you. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's in the nature of, I think signing up is in the nature at this point of a political statement. It's kind of activism. Mm-hmm. It's charity. It's the kind of thing that during your work day, you're going to put last on your to-do list. And I think that's the real problem with the service, is that there's not really any urgency to it. And because it doesn't offer that many different, that much of a different feature set. I mean, Twitter did something really new. People didn't quite understand it at first. For an awful long time, people didn't understand it, I think, because it did something so very new. It seemed kind of stupid to people because they didn't get how sort of transformative it could be. This doesn't have that. This is Twitter, and so the excitement and the urgency isn't there. I support the ideals behind it, but you know, there's lots of causes that I support that I'm not kind of out there actively working for, and I think it sort of, for me, falls into that category.
Mm-hmm. And for all of you who are getting excited about app.net, just realize. And when Mills joins, it'll be time to move on.
Well, right. We'll check back with you, Mills, in 2019 and see if you're on app.net.
you know, the other things that can give me pause about it as well is that this it's not as though this is an open source solution. It's not as though this is distributed. This isn't even moving the technology towards what towards a more interesting place. And I think that the fact that, you know, Dalton Caldwell's company has already received millions of dollars in investment from venture capital firms in Silicon Valley, it's a bit odd that he decided to crowdfund this. It definitely feels more of a political stance than it does actually sort of a viable business or a viable tech alternative. But yeah. I guess I'm a joiner, so there you go.
Right. All right. Well, we'll app each other or met each other. I can't remember what the approved term is. Post. We'll post to each other, Audrey. you know, I do think, and I'll link to this from the show notes, but you know, it is very developer oriented, and I think there may be a little space for some interesting innovation beyond Twitter in how individual developers extend the app.net platform. And it's really, you know, Dalton has set it up really as a platform. I think the alpha implementation is just, you know, it looks a lot like Twitter because that's what everyone's used to. But if you look at some of the discussions in the app.net developer community, you'll see that, for instance, Dalton and his team added a feature called annotations recently, which is sort of hidden text and other objects that you can attach to a, I'm not going to call it a tweet, but a post. And it can be long. You can have, I think, something like up to 10,000 characters. You could actually embed in a way, let's say a whole blog post in addition to the tweet that mentions the blog post. And so there are some developers who are working to do some interesting things on that front, particularly a group that is interested in having posts that are purely machine readable, so they're only this annotation payload. And so you could, you know, send out an app.net post that like turns on your lights at home or something like that. And so, you know, that I suppose is one area that's at least worth watching. But it seems like our current recommendation, at least 4 out of 5 Digital Campus podcasters this week recommend against getting your username for $50. Seems like that's maybe the case. Let's move on to some of the news about hardware, both over the summer and for the coming year. We are recording this on September 7th, 2012. And just yesterday, Amazon released some new tablets. Over the summer, I think we missed it because we were on hiatus, but Google released a very well-received 7-inch tablet called the Nexus 7. Next week, the new iPhone will come out and perhaps some other goodies from Apple. And next month, we'll see our first example of a live Surface machine from Microsoft. What are each of you looking forward to in the coming year? What would you like to buy? What do you think will make an impact on campuses? Maybe I could start with you, Amanda.
Yeah, boy, the question of what will make an impact on campuses is always a difficult one. But I will say that one thing that is going to make an impact on me is an announcement that Amazon just made yesterday. Amazon is coming out with a new high-definition Kindle. They're killing 8 megabyte Kindles. They're putting in high resolution. They have a new screen called Paperwhite, which is supposedly, you know, a bit less luminous than the Kindle Fire screen, but a bit more luminous than the e-ink screen. And I'm extremely excited about it. And I'm extremely excited about what they're calling immersion reading, which is basically a feature that will allow you to synchronize an audiobook with a Kindle book. Amazon owns Audible.com, and I really thought that I was the only person on the planet who will buy both an audiobook and an ebook and kind of read the book in both formats simultaneously, but apparently I am not, because Amazon has served our demographic by allowing you to sync up the ebook with the audiobook so that you can basically be reading one and pick up in the other format. whether what will be really, you know, popular on campuses or with students, maybe I will leave that for someone else to answer in the hardware space.
Audrey, what are you looking forward to?
You know, I actually just purchased a MacBook Air, which which I'm really thrilled about in terms of having a device that's sort of light like a tablet, but still actually has a functioning keyboard and sort of a fully functional computer. Mm-hmm. I'm not a huge fan of the tablet. Just with the work that I do, it feels to me like a luxury that I don't need to be lugging around.
Mm. You're a truck person, not a car person, to use Steve Jobs' analogy.
There you go. Yeah, but I do have an old school Kindle that I really do like for reading on, and so I would take a look at upgrading a Kindle before I would think about buying, whether it's an iPad or a Nexus or even a Kindle Fire. I'm much more interested in, you know, reading ebooks than I am sort of the tablet as a piece of hardware.
I should mention that Amazon's new line of Kindles, they seem to be moving more toward more toward the tablet space. Everyone always said that the Kindle Fire was a tablet, and I guess technically it is, but I have a Kindle Fire and an original Kindle. And to me, the Kindle Fire has always felt like sort of an ebook reader with some other stuff in it. Even though you can get videos and, you know, browse the web and do email and have apps and all that, it just, partly because it's book-shaped, you know, it's not square. It's kind of a lengthy rectangle. But you know, Amazon really does they do seem to be trying to really move. They have, you know, new form factors for what are, you know, much more tablet-like devices. And they're reaching out into getting people to game on these devices a lot more. They have a lot of features that they just announced yesterday about, offering features for gamers with their new Kindle. And then again, just having the HD display and supposedly better wireless. A couple of these things have two antennae rather than only one, which is supposed to make the Wi-Fi a bit better when you're on Wi-Fi. I think there's going to be a lot of people who will take another look at the Kindle line if they've been an iPad holdout so far.
Right, right. Tom, what are you looking forward to?
Say I'm looking forward to the Windows 8 tablets.
Yeah.
I think like Audrey, I don't have a tablet largely because although I do want one for reading. I mean, and not for reading books. I read books on my Kindle, regular old Kindle. But for reading, blog posts and newspaper articles and those kinds of things, I would like a tablet. But like Audrey, I want that tablet to be able to do my normal computing tasks as well. I want to be able to, if I'm like sitting in front of the TV reading an article in the New York Times and I get, an IM from you, Dan, that says, hey, could you take a look at this budget? I would like to be able to bring that budget up in Excel and like real Excel, not like fake pages Excel, like real Excel, so that like when I send it back to you, it's not all mangled. So I am looking forward to the Microsoft tablet because Microsoft is merging their desktop OS and their tablet OS. They are going to be the same thing. And so it will work when you want it to work like a computer. It will work like a computer when you want it to work like a reading device. It'll work like a reading device. Now, the risk is it may do both of those things badly. And that is, I think, a risk that Microsoft is taking, that, you know, it will be a kind of a crappy tablet and kind of a crappy laptop. I'm hoping that's not the case. I've been using the Windows 8 beta builds for a couple of months now. It's got its issues, but it's decent. I think it will be even more decent when I get it onto a touchscreen and to a tablet form factor. And the hardware that Microsoft has shown, just actually very briefly, is pretty compelling. It's a beautiful sort of slate, like the iPad, thin. Supposedly the build quality is very good, but it has as its cover a keyboard. instead of just a cover. And that I think is very compelling, that you could really, if you had a day full of meetings, really just bring that as your only device, and be able to, and be able to, you know, do all of the things you needed to do, and yeah, sort of be ready for any eventuality with that one device. So I'm looking forward to that.
I'm really thinking now, I have a brainstorm. I really think that the Center for History and New Media should get into hardware development. We just need to do that.
There you go.
Yeah.
Tomorrow.
We're going to start manufacturing things. We're
yes.
Gonna, we're
our Microsoft artisanal objects.
OEM.
Yes. Maybe just briefly, we need to wrap up, but Brian, what are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm with you guys on the Surface angle. I write most of my work, is, you know, lots and lots of writing, and I need a full keyboard. I have a hard time with the soft keyboard, so I'd prefer to do that. Also, like one of you said, I need to have full applications to work. But that said, I was a huge fan of the original Microsoft tablet. And I miss that. I mean, that was a really powerful, useful tool then, and now I fly a lot. And using a full laptop on a plane, especially in coach, is a real bear. So I suspect, beyond myself, we might see more interest in the Surface given the demand for writing. We had a small conference in Fairfax in April where we brought in, we had a panel on teaching with iPads, and several different campuses found that students were happy to use the iPads for just about everything except for long-form writing. That they could do a Twitter update, a Facebook update, but if they wanted to actually write a paper, they'd have to head off to a desktop or a laptop. So I wonder if the Surface will try and claim that area. Personally, I'm a Kindle fanatic, so I have hundreds and hundreds of books on my medium-age Kindle, and I'm happy to get more. But I don't think I'd want to consume video on it. I guess I'm a video decadent. I prefer to have a large screen to experience. So if I were to upgrade the Kindle, the only thing I'd want would be that nice Paperwhite screen and perhaps audio.
Right, right. Okay, Mills, you've got the last word. What's the one thing you're looking forward to from the upcoming year?
Mine will be completely different because, like Audrey, I've already gone out and bought my MacBook Air. I got that at the beginning of the summer. So for all the reasons that people have been saying, I couldn't keep trying to type on my iPad, so I went with the Air, and I'm loving it completely. So what I need, just in case anybody is thinking about my birthday, which is coming up next month, is the Canon EF 500mm prime lens. So just in case you're thinking, that's what I want.
Oh, that is incredibly specific. I am just jotting that down. Okay, Canon lenses.
The EF prime.
You're not happy with the iPhones or your Android phones camera?
It's just not quite doing it for me, no. I need a little more magnification.
Okay, well, we will put that on your Digital Campus Christmas list, or maybe October list. And we're a generous podcast this season. So if writers have other suggestions for things they'd like or that are looking forward to, you can always find us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can leave your suggestions for stories and comments on this podcast. It's good to have all of you on the podcast. Thanks for joining in. And we will talk to you again in 2 weeks on another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.